I note here that in the delegation there are a number of acting posts. But what I'd like to know is how many of these officials that are here today, senior officials, were not there during the period under review? Because that's something that crops up all the time, that we asking questions of people who say, well, we were not there, and we don't know about it, it was somebody else who's going to correct it. So I think as we start, it would be useful to know how many of them were there and how many of them were not there. Thanks.
Okay. I see there are, okay, there are three acting heads, regional coordination, infrastructure projects, asset investment management. And I'm aware that the DG only assumed office beginning of this year, and the CFO is also a couple of weeks. When I say couple, not more than 10 weeks in office. Yeah.
Wouldn't it help if we indicated we're here to take collective responsibility for the state of affairs in the DPW? So we're not here to say, well, we don't know what happened. We're here to take collective. So it's true that we're dealing with colleagues that have been for a long while in the department, a minister that has been for a relatively short while, a deputy minister for a shorter while, but still here. But we're not here to dodge issues. If we don't know the answer, we will obviously honestly say so. But we're here to take collective responsibility rather than to say, sorry, can't answer that because you weren't here.
Yeah, I would, Dr. George, I would plead that let us proceed. I was reluctantly responding to Sneak's question because I precisely did not want to have that becoming then a basis for excuses. So anyway, you people know I was not there, so I cannot, because then that might just muddy the waters. I hope, Honourable Singh, you can live with that.
No, sir, I can live. But my intention was not for them to say to us, but just to get a sense. From past experience on this committee, we know what we hear. And that's why I thought it might be useful just to say, well, 2011, 12, I was not there. You know?
No, it's fine. Let's get that in bits and pieces as we move along and as we deal with the issues. Comrade Roy, can I...
Thank you very much, Chair. I think we need to, in this engagement, attempt to try and get at the root causes of this department yet again receiving a disclaimer, which, as we know, is the worst possible audit outcome. What the Auditor General, in a sense, is saying that the financial statements and the performance information in the annual report are extremely unreliable. So I think it would be very useful to examine the root causes, and I think our committee, if one studies this annual report, our committee believes that the root causes are to be found in a lack of internal control. So I'm going to, instead of dealing with all the other, I think, nine reasons why the department receives a disclaimer, and I think the 18 or 19 additional matters, other emphasis of matters, I think we could very productively spend our time looking at this whole question of internal control and why it is lacking in the department. So that's just by way of an introduction, Chair, to what we'll be doing. And if you look at page 127 of the Auditor General's report, he gives a very good, very broad definition of what the fundamentals of internal control are. He says they are leadership, financial and performance management, and good governance. I would add underpinned by a good, functioning, effective audit committee. And I would argue that all these the three elements the AG mentions and the one I've added, the audit committee, are either lacking in the department or extremely weak. And so I will be spending some time. There's a very comprehensive report from the audit committee on page 86 to page 88 of the annual report. Very comprehensive. I must say one of the most comprehensive and honest audit committee reports we've had for a long time. So let me express my disappointment that the author of this report is not here. And in introductions, I heard nobody from the audit committee is here. Okay? And I'd hoped to engage somebody from the audit committee on this very comprehensive report on pages 86 to 88. But I'm sure, as the Deputy Minister has indicated, the department is here to take collective responsibility. I will ask those questions anyway, arising from the audit committee's report, and hope we can get some positive responses. First of all, let us remind ourselves of the importance of the audit committee. Audit committee processes reports from the internal audit function and then makes recommendations to management. It is at the very heart, it is key to sound financial management in any department. Now on page 86 of the report, the audit committee finds that the accounting officer and executive management team do not always attend all the meetings of the audit committee. They do not always attend these meetings of this vitally important committee. Just remind me, who is the executive management team? Who are we when they talk about executive management, who are we talking about? Can I ask the accounting officer just to, who is the executive management team?
Thank you, Chair. The executive management team of this department comprises of the DDGs responsible for the various branches of the organization. As the main component of that, there may be one or two chief directors who do not directly report to any DDG that are also members of the executive.
So the second question is why have accounting officers, why have these officials not been attending this committee at the heart of proper financial management in the department? Why has it happened? And then specifically now, with the current leadership, is there a commitment that, yes, indeed, we are going to attend this audit committee, we're going to cooperate, we're going to make it work? That's where this whole thing starts.
Can I respond?
So, yeah, if you can, what happened before? Why did they not attend? Yeah. And then your approach.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Chair. The approach that has been adopted, probably, which we have revised, given the enormity of these problems now, has been that the members of the executive committee attend the audit committee on the basis of need, generally. That means if there is an issue in your environment that requires you to be present in the meeting, you would attend. Going forward, we've both in the audit committee and also in MINMEC, I took a decision that effectively say executive management, at least at DDG level, must attend the meetings. I also take responsibility for attending all the audit committee meetings here and where I come from, because I understand the importance of attending those meetings for improving the governance of the organization.
We appreciate that. May I make a suggestion? If you look at page 86 of the report, there's a register of people who attend. Now, if you're saying that you will attend and you're saying your senior staff must attend, I would suggest that in future annual reports, that register includes you, it includes the senior officials and any others that ought to be attending those meetings, so we can have oversight as to whether management is indeed taking this committee seriously or not. It's a suggestion I would like to make. Chair, the Audit Committee also finds that while the Chief Audit Executive and the Office of the Auditor General attend all meetings, observers from National Treasury and the Minister's Office have permanent invitations. That's the word they use there, permanent invitations. Well, I don't know, maybe is that diplomatic speak for the Minister's Office and for the Treasury not attending these meetings? Because honestly, I believe that they too, in particular with regard to the Ministry, in my view, it is very important that there is a representative from the Minister's Office at those meetings. So we have a closer relationship between that office and this heart of good financial management. So again, I would have asked the people that came before these, I would have asked why did they not attend? But yes.
Who would you want to ask? I mean, Treasury and people in the Minister's Office?
I want to know from the Minister's Office, is there a commitment to send a representative to the... Has the Minister's Office been represented at this level? And if not, is there perhaps not a need that in going forward that that office ministry will be represented?
Chairperson, thanks. When I arrived, this was one of the complaints from the chair of the audit committee, that the ministry was absent in terms of even giving guidance on some of the issues. And since then, after coming in, we made it a commitment that at least somebody from our office does attend, and that's the case now.
No, Chair, I believe that's very important to have a close relationship between the Audit Committee and the Minister's Office, so we welcome that. Chair, the Audit Committee also finds that during the period under review, there were three acting Directors General. And we've heard here again today of a very high turnover in staff, especially at very senior level. And if you look at page 298 of the annual report, if you look at page 298 of the annual report, there's a very high turnover at senior staff level. On page 298, senior management service B and C at 22.2% turnover rate, senior management service B and D 50% turnover rate. Those are very low numbers, but important in terms of quality, in terms of leadership quality. Can the department indicate whether they have some kind of retention strategy to ensure that people at senior level are retained in the service of the department and that this expertise is not lost, as this table on 298 would indicate it is being lost? And we have the situation every time where we have a hearing of the department, we have new faces and people coming and going. What retention strategies do you have?
I think it's also important to give a context of the interpretation of that number. In generally, Chair, a department like ours, which requires high-skilled people, is in a market where there is high competition for those skills. In terms of the director relating to the question that you asked, the department does have a retention strategy, which is structured within the limits of the Public Service Act provisions, where if we are losing somebody, for an example, we are able to look at the package and counter offer within those limits. And secondly, I think in areas which may not necessarily be in this category of specialized skills, there is a dispensation that exists in government which then seeks to remunerate professionals in a manner that seeks to retain them. I think those are the limits of the strategy we have, but that strategy is being implemented. The two that may have left, we will need to just determine who they were and whether they would be in the category you want to retain.
Let us have an example. It's very useful to know why people come and go. Now, on page 299, there's again a very useful table there. It indicates why people leave the service. But let us take your most recent CFO as an example. CFO was there for a number of years. Why, under what circumstances, did that CFO, with all those years and years of experience, why did that person leave the service?
I think, and I'm sure the minister will come in as well,
yeah.
Because we're being asked a question about retrenchment strategy, but I'm sure later on, and perhaps that's where the Honourable Ainsley is going to right now, that's the market issue. People are in the market, we lose them, they come and go. But we're going to be asked a question just now. What are you doing about criminal charges against senior management?
What are
you doing about disciplinary measures?
I'm going to ask a whole long list of those questions.
And I think you can't look at the turnover issue in the senior management staff level as if it were just a market issue and not also an issue requiring decisive action. So retention, yes. But detention as well, actually. We need a detention strategy in this department, and I'm sure that we will come to that, but just to add that to the picture.
Let us talk about detention later on, because I have a number of questions regarding that. Let us quickly conclude this thing of detention. If you look at page 299, as I say, there are the lists of why people leave. 36.5% because their contracts expire. Would it not be possible to extend those contracts? 23.3% because of retirement. Would it not be possible to delay retirement? Just give me some kind of indication of why, if that is not possibly part of your retention strategy.
Because I think the issue around market and competition might be part of an explanation, because I don't want us to suggest that we don't have patriotic people. We only have professionals who are driven by money. Money is the only basis of a, you know, job or self-satisfaction. Comrade Minister.
Chair, when I respond to the committee, I always say it's better to be honest and open so that we understand the nature of the problem. You see, the issue or the question as raised by Comrade Roy is that the reality, instability at leadership level is the main cause of confusion. If you don't have stability at the top, you'll never have stability. And you'd remember that, I don't know how many years, after a number of years, it's only now that we have a permanent DG. That you have to take from the very DDGs, always acting themselves, in a department where there's a lot of resistance and a lot of competition. That is instability itself. But let me be honest and say, especially a department which in its mandate is very technical, because that's a technical department, there is no clear strategy to retain the technical professionals at the top level in the department. That is why, as part of our going forward, we want to create a dedicated professional services branch which is going to look into this question of all the professionals. Because if you're talking about that department, you need chartered accountants, you need property experts in the form of property economists. You need not just lawyers, property lawyers, and this whole range of the technical professionals. And part of the problem is that even those who have been coming, it has not been a well-planned project to say this is how they are getting in, this is how they are going to be retained. And it is very clear that there's been very, very poor strategy in terms of dealing with that. In fact, I can even say that the whole human resource department of Public Works is in shambles.
All right. No, it's fine.
Let us get back to internal audit function. The audit committee in the same pages I'm referring to in the same report. Audit committee claims responsibility for ensuring the internal audit function has the necessary resources and standing within the department to enable it to discharge its duties. I wonder if in the assessment of the accounting officer, it's only been there since January, I know, January, February, March, not even 3 months yet, but has he been able to make an assessment of the effectiveness of the audit committee during the period under discussion? Given the fact of a lack of internal control in the department, given the fact that the AG finds that internal audit function is weak, given the fact on page 87 of this report, observations of the audit committee are that the internal audit function lacks capacity. Now, I'm saying that you've had, while we applaud this very comprehensive report, maybe over this period, one of the problems has been that this audit committee has not been functioning properly. What is your assessment since January?
My observation with regard to the audit committee, firstly, the terms of engagement from the previous audit committee came to an end during the course of the year. A new audit committee was appointed during the course of last year. In January, beginning of February, the scheduled meeting of the audit committee took place. In fact, I've had two meetings with the audit committee so far. And as new members already, I'm certain that at least from a skills perspective and experience, they've already started to look at the issues that were raised last year. And they asked for the action plans. In the engagements I had, is that I think we have an audit committee that is going to take us to task, that are going to assist me in the responsibility of accounting officer in dealing with the matters. In that regard, I think I think from that perspective, we will be on good ground. With regard to the capacity of internal audit, as part of the restructuring program, I think, let me indicate, firstly, the head of internal audit is at a chief director level within the department. And if I read what they were saying last year, effectively they say, unless either there is emphasis from an accounting officer's office to give effect to the effectiveness and the authority of the internal audit, you need to have that position given the adequate authority to take responsibility and be effective within the organization. That's one part. And that part is being addressed through the restructuring process. The second part is the capacity within it. Last year, as part of the turnaround strategy, during the adjustment budget, some part of the amount that was allocated to the department as part of the environment and reallocation was aimed at strengthening the internal audit unit to fill in the gap, the vacancies that had been there which were largely contributing to the issue of the capacity that is that the audit committee would have been referring to. So that work has now been done. We anticipate that in the current year, I think in April, the audit committee is going to be sitting to review the audit plan of the internal audit unit going forward for the current year. Simultaneously with that, as we conclude the structure, we'll then be able to start to upgrade the level and look at the areas where there are deficiencies and conclude that process of ensuring that the internal audit function is respected and is able to apply. As I say, the major part of it is the attitude from my office. If I do not give them support that is required, with all the will in the world, they may not be effective to the extent that they should be.
Correct.
And that commitment is there.
Okay.
Yes, I like what you've just said, that you take responsibility for this audit committee. What I didn't like about this report, and I would have engaged with the author of this audit report, was that they seem to take all the responsibility for ensuring that the audit committee is resourced. Yet in Section 38 of the PFMA, it is the accounting officer's responsibility, I think, to ensure the functioning of this committee. So we appreciate that. You said in your response you hope you have an audit committee that will take you to task. We hope so. We hope more, though. We hope that you will be responsive to the reports of the audit committee, and that's what is lacking here. You have a very comprehensive, I think a very critical report from the audit committee, which was ignored, largely ignored by everybody. So it's not only a case of being taken to task. You must be responsive, I hope, to the work of this committee. Am I lecturing?
I think we
get the point.
To some extent, do need that.
On page 87 of the same report, the audit committee speaks about weakness in the CFO's office. Now we can't have that. Again, this is if the audit committee is the heart of good financial control in the department, then the CFO's office, the lungs. We can't have a CFO's office that is unresourced, that doesn't have capacity. What are you doing to strengthen? Do you think that observation is correct, first of all? And if so, what are you doing to strengthen the CFO's office?
That is correct. When I arrived, that was one of the first areas that I needed to understand in terms of the capacity. Fortunately, the new CFO's appointment was then concluded, which is a good beginning, because when I arrived, there were acting people in that environment. Secondly, I then looked at the structure itself and the deficiencies with regard to some of the things that I understand should be carried out in that environment, which are currently not taking place simply because of, amongst other things, the reason provided by the audit committee about the capacity in the chief financial office. You will have seen that we started to advertise posts in the CFO's office. I've had discussions with the relevant parties in the National Treasury around the issue of the constraints we had with regard to increasing compensation in the department, and there was an agreement and acceptance that this area is priority area. And therefore, all those vacancies we are going to start to fill in. There were vacancies at the chief director level, two of them. They are in the process of, they were advertised, they will be filled very soon. And that's part of stabilizing that environment. We're also looking at some of the areas which we are deficient in the CFO's environment, which we are also now starting, as some of which are part of the operation clean audit and the restructuring process. So we in the new year, I hope to have a situation where at least the CFO's office and the whole of finance is in place. I'll let the CFO add a few words with regard to that.
Thank you, DG. Thank you, members. I think the issue around the CFO office, one is to look at it from what are the CFO offers in the structure or in the way the department is organized works. You'll agree with me that this is a fairly decentralized environment. We've got about 11 regions.
Yeah.
So the span of control in terms of 11 regions is kind of difficult. But the way we are structured in terms of the reporting and accountability is highly problematic, in the sense that your regional heads of finance, and there's a lot that happens down in the regions in terms of transactions and all that. So we need to have a fundamental relook at the way things are happening. So the weaknesses in the CFO's office are symptomatic of what's happening in terms of the way the department is structured and the accountability set up.
So would you say that it may be the weaknesses in the regional offices as much as anything else that accounts for this lack of general internal control in the department?
I would say it's across the board, but largely in that area, because that's where most of the activity is taking
place. Chair, on page 87 of this audit committee report, right at the very top, I think, yeah, the top of page 87, the second paragraph from page 87, the report speaks of the lack of business processes and compliance with policies and procedures as a major concern. Now, most concerning there is the observation that there was inadequate action to deal decisively with those who were not complying. Now, I honestly would like to know who those are. And I'm wondering when the new accounting officer and the new CFO read this report, they did not immediately ask themselves the question, who are those? Who are these people? And did they perhaps launch some kind of internal investigation or even interrogate the author of this report as to who these people are? And then...
All right, don't dip very deeply into compliance issues. Because Dr. George, I'm sure, will deal with that. But the question stand.
Yeah. So answer it then.
Yeah.
I think, Chair, when one started and we've had several meetings with the CFO around that issue. If you go through the audit report itself, with the experience one has, you got a sense, you came to the same conclusion that there is a significant problem of internal control as well as lack of compliance, because there are quite a lot of compliance issues that were raised by the Auditor General, which I think we're able to observe and see that they are in place. If that statement relates to a number of the areas that the Auditor General found, and those areas would include...
Chair, you see, we're always very interested in those. We always in this committee want to know who.
Yes.
Who are these people? Now, is there any attempt? Has there been an attempt? Will there be an attempt to identify who are these people?
Yes.
Whose actions are, in a sense, maybe not directly, but indirectly, at least sabotaging the work of the department. Are they still there? They may be there with you, maybe sitting behind you. Surely there must be on your part an intention to find out who these people are.
Chair, I think Minister will...
Because the Minister, the Deputy Minister, and you and the CFO are only going to be as strong as the people around you. And I would be very concerned if I were you about this statement.
I think, Chair, if you read the announcements that have been made around the findings through the investigations, there are people who are already known.
Okay, maybe
as part of
okay,
that.
Let's
but
to, when we talk about detentions.
Yes.
And just remind me, that's not a compliance issue. I'm doing that. Is that right? Investigations and so on. Who's doing that?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay, but let me carry on.
Maybe we can come back to the issues around investigation.
Let me carry on. Chair, also there on the same page, the Chair of the Audit Committee uses very strong language to describe the working environment of the department. He talks of a non-compliance culture. Now, the way I read that is that it is the norm it is standard procedure in this department that laws and regulations simply are ignored and not complied with. Now, I know, accounting officer, you've only been there a few months, but how have you been able to characterize the working environment at the department in terms of what the audit committee has found, this non-compliance culture?
I know these things are interrelated.
Okay, maybe Dr. George will ask.
Yeah, well, if he doesn't, he'll still come.
But I want to give an example of non-compliance culture. May I do that? Irregular expenditure. May I do that?
No, not now. Not now. Maybe, Comrade Roy, let's do this. I don't know what you still have. Could allow Dr. George, because internal controls invariably leads to non-compliance.
Yes.
So these two things will, you know, intermingle from time to time. So maybe if we allow him to get into his heads of questions, and then we can then have an unrestricted, you know, engagement on...
The audit committee on page 87 suggests that a way of ensuring accountability is to include governance responsibilities in senior management's performance contracts. I would have asked the chair of the audit committee what he meant by governance responsibilities that he would like to see in performance contracts. Would you care to make a comment on that? What kind of governance responsibilities do you think he would like to see in performance contracts?
Chair, in some in environments where this situation has occurred, you would add the issues that relate to audit outcomes as part of the performance in each of the areas of the DDG, so that if there are negative findings that arise from the work of a DDG, and that is part of the governance, the issues that I will enlist some of them. In detail, because they largely are found in the report and the findings of the audit general. If a DDG, in a DDG's environment, there are audit findings that are negative, then that means that DDG is failing to fulfill, and the DG, by the way, all of them are already a requirement for the DG. That DDG is failing to deliver, to perform his mandate with regard to governance. And if there is irregular expenditure that arises from his environment, if there are serious deficiencies or financial misconduct that arise from that environment, obviously subject to proper investigation and verification of reasons, etc., that is the DDG is responsible. And that would affect either the extent, if they are serious, the extent to which that DDG then faces the music with regard to that environment. And if they are...
What would constitute serious? What is serious?
Serious issues relate to matters of financial misconduct. If they incur irregular expenditure, if they fail to perform...
Fruitless and wasteful expenditure.
Unauthorized expenditure. Yes. Those are the areas that would be taken.
Some have taken that suggestion further and suggested that in your contract and the contract of the CFO, there is a reference to achieving clean audits, or at the very least achieving certain milestones towards a clean audit, or else you face the music. Now, how would you comment on that? Would that not focus management's attention in a very real way on achieving clean audits that we aspire to? So in your contract and the CFO, these are the milestones, chup, towards clean audit. Achieve them or else. How would you react to that?
Chair, I would react positively to that, because that is a requirement.
What is your... Do you have a performance contract in place already, or when is it going to be drawn, Comrade Minister?
That's the matter we're busy with, because we've just appointed him. we think that in the next, in fact, by the end of the first quarter, when he has started that performance contract must be ready. But also, let me add...
When does the first quarter end? Is it not next week?
No, he started mid-January, yes. So it would mean mid-April.
Okay.
But what we're also doing, we've had to dig deep to speak to TBSA, to second somebody at a DDG level, even to help us in terms of reviewing the performance contracts of the DDGs to make them responsible for their areas like the DG has said. And in fact, to factor in the issues which Comrade Roy was talking about, that they should take responsibility in terms of their finances also in their own areas.
But Comrade Minister, I suppose that should be the norm, isn't it?
It's supposed to be the norm, but you sit it with very weak performance contracts.
All right.
If I may conclude then, Chair, with regard to the CFO, certainly as we agree that governance is part of every DDG's responsibility, it can also be regard to every member of SMS, somebody who's in senior management position needs to have a responsibility that relates to that with regard to their area of operation. The same arrangement with the CFO, to the extent that then I hold each DDG responsible if the matter comes in the environment and the CFO is not directly responsible for that. The CFO would then be, his area of responsibility will be identified in the report, and we will then work out a performance agreement that realistically shows whether we're making progress given the challenges that we have. So, I think that's how
it's structured. Okay, that's fine. Comrade Roy?
I think the CFO is his end up.
Okay.
May I add, in light of what the DG was saying, in terms of Section 45 of PFMA, every official in the department has a responsibility towards ensuring that all these financial misdemeanors do not happen. I think even though the overarching responsibility rests with myself and the DG, if you look at the actual detail of the audit itself or findings, majority of the audit findings come from line function. So because we're sitting with that situation, we cannot underestimate the importance of fixing the responsibility of ensuring a clean audit outcome to all senior management. And I think that's the principle we're going to apply in this instance.
CFOs before that accept that they are accountable for that, but when that is not achieved, there are no consequences. So I'm saying that in these performance contracts, there must be consequences if certain milestones are not met. So we need to go beyond simple pure accountability. There must be consequences for senior management who did not achieve particular milestones. I think the minister had his hand up.
Yeah, Comrade Minister.
Comrade Roy, we have started. There are consequences. The previous CFO was requested to resign or face charges of misconduct. That was because of the, or I must say, this was prompted by the financial state of the department. So that is the beginning of that process. You had to start at the top to say, if we continue with this, it's either you resign or you face these charges. So I think we're going to continue with that. But the reality is, you need to put the right head in a particular unit who is then going to follow up with the staff below. But if you don't have the right head, you would continue to have a mess.
Now, that is the kind of decisive action I think we are looking for, which will take us beyond this disclaimer.
Chair, the Audit Committee report talks about an action plan that the department developed to deal with the previous year's disclaimer and all the emphases of matter and all the additional matters in that report, and complaints of slow progress being made in implementing that action plan to look at and deal with the Auditor General's findings. Since your appointment, accounting officer, have you reviewed this action plan to deal with previous year's audit outcomes, and why is progress slow if it is still slow?
Yes, I have reviewed it and I have looked at it. I have also started to identify some of the areas that were not even covered in that process. I think I could not deal with the issue of why it was low. I think that the major reason might have been that I think part of these leadership gaps and processes resulted in inertia in the process. But that has now been arrested. Let me say, indicate, short measures we have put in place to just make sure that the issue of the audit outcomes receives attention that is required. The department put together a specifically dedicated project clean audit, which is focused on dealing with the issues in the action plans and the necessary processes that are necessary for the department to deal with. Processes, policies, processes, and the internal controls that are deficient in the process of dealing with this. At the executive management level or at the governance level, I have instituted a dedicated monthly sessions which would not be dealing with anything else but matters of governance, matters of the audit report, monitoring the progress with regard to how we are implementing the action plans and responding to these things. And that includes a much more closer process of dealing with the misdemeanors that were found from the process, from the perspective of the actions that are necessary as part of holding the people who were responsible for them accountable. That clean audit project, Chair, will be the instrument we are using to monitor and ensure that we set the necessary changes within the organization.
Chair, I want to deal with those misdemeanors, but I think you ruled that it is Dr. George's focus area. So I shall defer then to Dr. George, and if he doesn't cover that entire area, will you please allow me time to follow up?
Sure.
I have questions going all the way back to 2008. So if Dr. George doesn't cover that entire period, please can I have
no
a second chance?
Sure, no problem. Dr. George?
Thank you, Chairperson. My understanding with Mr. Ainslie, Honourable Ainslie, was that he needed to leave early, and so that's why he went first.
That's
fine. I'm sure he'll be leaving shortly. thank you very much for the Minister and the Deputy Minister to come here today. I think it's wonderful to see you both. Minister, you mentioned about a CFO who was offered an opportunity to resign instead of face the consequences or criminal charges or whatever. Now, I completely disagree with my colleague, Honourable Ainslie, as that's decisive action. I think that is not decisive action. And that is one of the reasons why the system is broken, is because somebody does something really bad and then is allowed to go and work somewhere else in the public financial system and maybe do the same thing there. We know this problem is not only found in public works. It is everywhere. So I would like to know from the Minister, who is this or was this CFO, and where is he or she now?
The person is Kate Motsitz. I don't know where she is. You see, Can I just explain the context, Chairperson? Under normal circumstances, you want to charge. But the problem, you know, in the public service, you can charge, it can take you a year, 2 years, dealing with that particular person.
What's the problem with the public service and its ability and inability?
No, it has to do with the laws in the public service. People can even bring advocates in the hearings. And hearings...
How did we come to that?
I don't know. I don't know. If I was still on the other side, I would answer that. But that's a reality which you're sitting with. In fact, some of the outstanding cases we are dealing with, and they tend to be too costly. And whilst you're dealing with that particular case, remember, you can't fill in that particular post. You can't fill in that post. You must have an acting person. And persons these days think about job security. You can't take a top-level person somewhere to come and act without knowing in terms of job security. So we had to even assess that. And when you have been sitting with these disclaimers in the department, preceded by a lot of qualifications, we needed quick action. It might not have been the best which was supposed to have been done. But under those circumstances, you needed a quick exit for that particular person whom, according to my assessment, was not helping the process.
All right.
So that was the context.
Okay. That's fine. Dr. George?
Thank you, Minister. So my understanding is that the law is complex to administer, and there's a long process. And, of course, workers must have rights, and, of course, we all support that 100%. However, what you're saying is that that system doesn't work. And then, if somebody has to have a quick exit from one department, they go to somewhere else, and then maybe they need a quick exit there too. And then so it goes. So I would suggest, I put it to you, Minister, that perhaps somewhere a stand needs to be taken, or the law needs to be looked at to make it perhaps maybe have the contracts a little more tightly written or something, so that, you know, if the person doesn't comply, then you can have a quick exit. But that's a debate for a different time. But I think that's very useful information. Thank you very much. Then the Deputy Minister mentioned collective accountability. Now, I would like him to just explain what that actually means. Because it seems to me that, in a way, collective accountability means, yes, we're all accountable. Nobody's here anymore, so we all sit here and we all agree it was really bad and that we'll fix it in the future. But there's no real concrete action. So my question is, who is responsible within this collective accountability? Is it the minister? Now, of course, the minister's gone, or the previous ministers. We have a minister now, but he wasn't there when this all happened, so it's not possible to hold him to account for that. So the minister at the time that this happened, is that person responsible, or those two persons, or whatever they were, responsible? And if they are, what has happened to them or will happen to them?
If we're to use the results of the investigations about some of the processes, wrong processes in the department, and mainly emanating from the supply chain, those were initiated during the time of my predecessor. But when I came in, I had to act on this. As we speak, we can safely say we've dealt with almost 13 officials thus far. But remember, these processes, they take their own time, like I've indicated. There are DC processes which started last year. We're implementing those. If the investigations are showing us that, yeah, there were serious violations of the supply chain processes or whatever, we act on those issues. That's why we've dealt with 13 people. 22 more are still in line. And so collective responsibility says, if it is within our responsibility, whether it was by the previous minister, whether it was happening in whatever particular unit, at the end of it, all of us have to act on that particular anomaly and try and correct it. That's what it means. So that's how we are dealing with those issues, regardless of when they've been identified. I can't say because I've just come yesterday, I can't act on them. I have to act. The same with the DG. He has to act on a lot of issues as a DG, which have happened long before he arrived in this particular department.
Right.
In fact, some of the cases, they go back as 2006, 2007, and we're acting on them.
All right. Okay.
Thank you, Minister. For clarifying that, and I understand that the action is taken by officials, and it's concerning this committee that it's lower level officials that always end up carrying the can and not necessarily the higher level ones, but we'll get into that a bit later.
Let me correct that. A DDG is gone. A DDG whose former acting DG is under the DC. So it's quite senior people whom we're dealing with.
Thank you very much, Minister.
Just to catch back to an earlier thing, I didn't have a chance to come in because the Honourable Dion said that we accept that workers have rights and so on, but obviously that's not the specific issue here. But I think when we're dealing with the senior management level, are we strictly talking about workers or a different kind of reality, senior public servants? Is it the same as worker rights? And I think that, without going into the detail, but I think the chairperson will understand where I'm going.
Okay.
I think we need to be careful of not suggesting that the problems we've got here, correctly as you're now implying, apply largely to the senior. That's not to say there are problems occurring at the lower level. They're occurring at the senior level. And is the legislation that we've got appropriate, not to protect workers' rights, but to ensure that we're able to deal effectively with a senior management level? I think that's the issue. And I wanted to say that earlier.
Thank you very much for clarifying the issue
and
separating the various levels or social formations so that we don't generalize. And
thank you very much, Chairperson. I absolutely agree with that, is that at a senior level, it is a different scenario. The pay is obviously a lot higher because the responsibility apparently is more, and therefore people who are working at that level should have a set of rules that work for them. For example, there is no reason why somebody who comes into a senior position, for example a DG, gets a contract that is implementable in law that says you must deliver X. And if you do not, in other words, if you do not have the proper financial processes in place, then you go. It's that simple. So perhaps that is something that we can look at, and I really think everybody would support that. But Minister, I was talking specifically about political accountability. Now, SCOPA is a body of Parliament, and we hold departments and ministers politically accountable because we go report back to Parliament. And in your response, I didn't hear much about that political accountability because there was a minister. It was not you, it was somebody else. And that person, I don't even know where they are, but they are somewhere else. But is that person held to account? And if the question is not for you, Minister, then it is to the Cabinet, because that's collectively accountable. And if it's not to them, then it's to the President, in my understanding. So are you able to shed any light on that political accountability for the minister that was in place at the time?
Chairperson, the fact that
I think, Comrade Minister, maybe let's do this. I hear the concerns of Honourable George. But you see, if you look at the PFMA, officials who have left the department but have committed acts that amount to criminality, you pursue them through the law enforcement agencies. But an official who has, you know, infringed the rules and the procedures within the department that do not amount to criminality, once that person has left the department, there is no way you can bring that person back and seek to discipline. may, in terms of the responsibilities of the accounting authority, I think the level of responsibility that you are pushing towards would apply when the person is still there. But once the person has left, I'm not sure what mechanism in law exists to can then seek to hold them further accountable in terms of the lapses, the omissions that might have happened in the department. So I'm just clarifying that, but if you feel there is a point that must still be answered, you can go ahead. I was just trying to clear a little bit.
It's my view, Chairperson, that regardless of the office of the person, if there are violations, if they are criminal, anybody can be followed. Anybody. But there was accountability with my predecessor, because what I am acting on now, high-level cases, I think I've mentioned them in my press statements, the various projects and so on. It's what was instituted during the time of my predecessor. She is the one who identified, or he is the one who identified problems, and approach the president for a proclamation to say, we need to dig deep here. There are serious violations. So I think it's just that things I'm acting on which were started by somebody else. That's why I might be seen to be starting to act. Because even the investigation, we must accept, they are going to take their own time. Sometimes we even get frustrated ourselves with the nature of the investigations. But what else do you do? Because there must be a proper investigation which becomes conclusive. Let me also just raise the last issue, which I should have raised, Chairperson. This issue of how to deal with fast-tracking the cases for the senior management, that has even come to the attention of the cabinet, and I think the DPSA is looking into this matter, because it has not just frustrated this department, it has frustrated even other departments. So it's a serious question which is being looked into.
Thank you very much. Honourable Ainslie covered a number of areas of internal governance, but I just wanted to remark on the disclaimer. Now, obviously, we know what a disclaimer means. It's that really, you know, this beautiful glossy document, it's not really very valid. I mean, obviously, the comments of the Auditor General are very, very useful, and the reports from the Audit Committee, etc. But we don't know for sure whether this is correct or not, because we can't really get an opinion on it. And so this report really talks about a system that is broken down. I mean, if I read the section that I was asked to look at, compliance and laws that start from 124, it just reads like a horrible horror story, frankly, where things were not done and just one after another. So I don't want to go into the minute detail of it, or else we will, as the chairperson mentioned, sit all day. But I just want to talk basically about the basic pillars of finance that should be in place. It's very simple. I keep saying this in this committee, is that there should be financial procedures, they should be in place, and they should be properly managed. There's evidence that that was not there. Then we should have an internal audit function. It should test what is going on in the department. It should report to the audit committee, which it didn't do properly. The audit committee should then be doing things. It should be looking at the reports. It should be making commentary to management. Management should participate, correct what they find. And then that would lead to the quarterly reporting that gets done, which I don't think is being done either. And then that means that when the Auditor General gets their reporting to audit, it's in a more or less okay state to be audited upon. Now that isn't rocket science. It's not that difficult. It's just basic principles, which are not there. I just wanted to ask about those quarterly reports. Are they being done now?
Quarterly financial statements, Chair, as prescribed in terms of the interim financial reporting, are not being done. As I have discovered that is why I had to go through and look at what is the weaknesses in the whole entire in the whole finance division. That's been the situation with regard to up to now. We will certainly by the 1st of April, I will institute that these things are done. And as you correctly say, some of them are standard procedures in a financial management environment. The CFO has accepted that. I think he's going to make comments with regard to that. We are now fixing and putting in place the processes that will ensure that we are able to produce those financials. They will now form part of our quarterly performance report, because that is being done on a quarterly basis. But the financial reporting, as outlined, as structured in terms of the guidelines issued by National Treasury for quarterly interim reporting, that has not been done in this department. That's probably why then there would have been a good reason for dealing with the structure that they were set in finance at the time, in the manner that the minister has indicated with regard to the CFO, the previous CFO. But I can promise you in it will be done from the first quarter, because we're just going to have to report the annual reporting on the 31st. Otherwise, the quarter report would have started by the 31st of March. But from the first quarter of next year, we'll comply with all of that as a department, as we should. And we are fixing that. As I say, it's also been identified. We've added as part of the issue of dealing with clean audit, because we need to have those quarterly reports to help us to identify any action that is required for us to have compliant annual financial statement at the end of the year.
Thank you very much. So it was clear to me then, we're now on 11-12. 12-13 is probably not going to look very good either. Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see when the time comes. Thank you very much. I just then want to go briefly through page 125 of the financial statements, where it lists issues of compliance with laws and regulations. Now, I don't want to go through every single one of them, because it really is a lot. So I just want to touch on a couple of items.
Which page, Dr. Jones?
125 on the annual financial statement.
That's fine.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. First section is talking about annual financial statements, performance, and the annual report. I won't go through that, because it really identifies misstatements, etc. I think we get what happened. Then on the asset management, that there weren't proper controls and safeguards to maintain assets were not implemented according to the Act. I think my question is, why is that the case? Or is the answer the same as we've heard before?
Perhaps the first part. The second part, I'm not sure whether before as today or before this hearing. But I think, Chair, the AG identified these areas. The audit committee has confirmed that has been the practice in the department. We've also acknowledged, and I think we've acknowledged it very explicitly, that there are these weaknesses that exist. We have the action plan and the structure to deal with it going forward. I confirm that those findings were correct. What we have done in the action plan is to then say what needs to be done in order for these things to be dealt with. The issues that relate to the asset management, I think, are huge. They also relate to the immovable asset, which is a big project on its own, which is going to take quite some time to come to its conclusion, but at least up to today, considerable progress has been done. We have also structured the project towards resolving the issues. We've been able to identify even the extent of the complexity and the dependencies, some of which are outside of the mandate of public works, such as those in the Surveyor General's environment in the Department of Land for Rural Development, etc. We've put in place, therefore, the proper engagements with those parties, so that in the cases where it is there is capacity, we try to we influence them to look at their process and see if they cannot speed them up. But they have their own deadlines, which suggest but the, for example, it may, we may not resolve all issues that relate to the immovable asset register issues until around 2017, to be realistic, because you have to structure your own timelines on the basis of the longest period of resolving issues that are outside of your control in terms of the plans that are developed by those people. And that's the sense in which we are dealing with them. Yes.
Thank you very much. I think now we're going to get into some of the meat that Honourable Ainslie started talking about regarding accountabilities of individuals. The next item talks about budgets, compensation for employees that was exceeded. Now, I don't have all the details on it, but are we talking here about extra salaries to people? Are we talking about bonuses? And if we are talking about bonuses in particular, or anything that can be clawed back from people who should not be entitled to this money, has there been any action on that?
Thank you. Well, since my arrival, I requested a full analysis of what are the contributing factors to this. I think it is important to note that this department has a few contradictions with regard to compensation. The one is that we are lacking on key skills that are required, which we must have and buy, as we have to have our business going forward. The other is that over a period of time, we've been able to have skills that do not relate to the core business that exist within the department, you know, the general skills, general areas. And over the periods, there have been appointments driven by requirements of the day, some of which are over and above establishment. And the third one is, which I think is a technical issue that CFO has had to deal with, a proper costing of the resources we have. Those, the combination of all of those things, because you'll realize that we had this situation in 2011-12, we didn't have in 2010-11. We had it in the year before that.
Let's simplify it, because I'm trying to follow. And I hope the response could be as simple as this question. We exceeded the budget for compensation of employees. Why and how? I think that was the substance of his question.
Chairperson, the real nub of my question was this. Were any bonuses paid, perhaps to any executives, for example, that, I mean, clearly the department did not perform. So if that was the case, can they be clawed back? So in other words, has any of the people's money been spent on individuals who didn't do the job they were supposed to do and were overcompensated for it? Thank you.
I will request one of my colleagues to assist me with regard to that. My initial analysis has been that there has not been at least bonus paid to executives in the period that I read.
It's there in the annual report. Senior management did not get any bonuses.
Yes. I'm going to ask Mandla to complete any parts of that that are useful.
No, Chair, I can just confirm what the DG is saying, that there were no payment of bonuses to all SMS members.
No, that's fine. I've put a rider. Why did we exceed the budget? What led to it?
Chair, maybe if I may just try and assist as well in terms of the response as to why the overexpenditure on the budget of compensation. I think also it's a question of honesty that the department, in terms of its structure, has a very high vacancy rate, but we spend more than what we had budgeted for, because we have a situation where we have people positions that are not on the structure. We have a lot of contract people, and yeah. So I think the issues
how do you have people who are not in the structure, in the employ of the department? How were they employed? On what basis to fill what vacancies?
Chairperson, can I maybe just add something while you're answering? Item on page 12656, the first, very, very first line on page 126, talks about persons in charge of pay points did not always certify that the employees receiving payment were entitled thereto. So maybe we can just talk to that as well. So clearly what seems to be happening is money was getting paid to people. Perhaps people, I don't know if everybody was actually on the payroll or should have been on the payroll, and I think that's something we'd like to know. Thank you.
I think the DG spoke of skills mismatch, that the way people had been appointed in the department was not in line with the core functions. You see, for instance, let me make an example that you want an accountant, you appoint a clerk. Or you want an engineer, you end up with some low
appointed
level
teacher.
Come on, I'll pick the teachers. That might be the example.
Well, I was a teacher myself for a while.
Don't make yourself a minister of health when he talks about CEOs of hospitals. They're teachers. You want an engineer. You end up with a low-level project manager. Now, or somebody who has been appointed to be a director or a chief director, not performing, instead of following that person in terms of the performance and penalize that person, you remove that person, you bring the other person, you say the person must be deployed somewhere. So you have a lot of those things. And those are senior positions, they are very costly in the department. So just ad hoc, that's why I've been saying that one of the problems is the HR in the department, but also this excitement of instead of making people account and having consequences if they are not performing or they are underperforming, you start saying let them be deployed somewhere, you bring in somebody else. That has been the chaos in the department. So as long as we don't deal with those issues of underperformance, the way you have to deal with the underperformance, because you have to take people through a process and so on, if they continue, you have to relieve them. But we seem to be afraid to deal with those issues.
Okay. Thank you very much. Then the next item is expenditure management, and it talks a lot about the accounting officer. Now, clearly, if you read all of this section, clearly the accounting officer didn't do their job. It's very clear. Now, my question is, well, who was the accounting officer at the time? I've got a name here in the front. If it's the same person, I don't know, because there's so much churn, I'm not really sure anymore. That's the one thing. So what is the name of the accounting officer? And secondly, have criminal charges been pressed?
I might not be able to. I'm subject to correction. The, I would guess, the some of the DDGs, two of them, Mandla Mabuza has once acted as a DG. Recently, before this appointment, was Mandisa. Prior to Mandla was Sam Vugela, who is now facing the charges. He's under DC. And prior to Sam Vugela, it was Dongwana. The problem is, it might be during those periods, but you would find that most of them, it would just be a period of 3 months or 6 months and so on. It becomes very difficult to pin down a particular person. Then it leads to this question I've been raising, that as long as we have instability at the top leadership level, it's very difficult even to follow up and pin the people. And you know, a person who's acting, indeed, that person is really acting, would just do the job, won't be as assertive as a person who is permanent in that particular position. And I think that has been the problem. And I think some of the things have happened during the era of Mandla Mabuza. Some of them might have happened during the era of Mandisa, some under Uvukela. But that has been the problem. For instance, the permanent DG, Dongwan, who was a chartered accountant, believe it or not, had been in that department for 3.5 months before his suspension. That's the type of the instability which you're facing in that particular department. And we hope now, in fact, we've never had a permanent DG since 2008, if I'm right. We've never had. We hope that with this appointment, we're going to be able to follow the issues systematically and so on. That has been part of the problem. And of course, if there are criminal issues, what we normally do, for instance, arising out of the SIU reports, we deal with the DC, we pass the criminal cases to the law enforcement, then it moves out of our hands. I know that we have opened about, how many, three cases? Two or three. But there are cases, we'll just get the information, where we've opened criminal cases. But once we do that, that now it's at the level of the police and the other justice processes. It's no more within us.
Thank you, Minister. And the reason why I raise it is because we have laws, we process them obviously for a reason, and the law has got teeth in it that says if you steal the people's money or you don't manage the people's money properly, you can go to prison. And we've never exercised that law, we've never done that, and I think if we're going to break the cycle, that needs to happen at some point. So there is no reason why all four of those people that you've mentioned, or maybe even more, who were responsible. The law says you have to do certain things, and you're employed and you're paid a lot of money to do it. The people's money pays you to do it. So if we took, for example, all of the people in the financial year that were involved in this in any way, and they all had to face the necessary charges and be held to account for what they've done with the people's money in the time that they were there, it will do several things. It would send a very strong signal to everybody else, do not take a job that you cannot do, because if you do not do it, there will be consequences. That's how it works. And it will also demonstrate the willingness to do something about it and stop the cycle, because the hemorrhaging cannot continue like this. I mean, everybody's agreed. But anyway, enough about that. And then the next item is financial misconduct. It spoke about investigations that have not been conducted. Now, I know this report was at 31st of March, 2012. So can I safely assume that all of the investigations that should have been done are either started or are somewhere, and that any necessary disciplinary hearings have started and are somewhere? Is that correct? So there's nothing that hasn't yet been started in terms of taking action on what happened here.
No. There are investigations going on. There are about 9 cases which have been opened, criminal cases for that matter. In fact, that's what is being brought to my attention. Investigations, you would know by the SIU, the very nature I've indicated, are ongoing. As the results are coming, we act on those. And on some of them, we've gone through the DCs. Some people have been expelled. Just from the top of my head, I know that ADDG was expelled. I know that some directors in one of our Gauteng region have been expelled. It was a publicly reported case where somebody was earning about 90,000 per month instead of 10,000 from the service provider. So all those cases are what were passed to the police. So they continue to come and we are acting, but the problem, it's not at a pace we would love them to. But also what we have decided through the experience of the DG, where he's coming from, together with the Treasury, we're putting a risk management branch where we also want to have our own investigative capacity. And I think the Treasurer has come up with that idea. He has also come up with that idea because he has experience in housing, so that we don't refer everything into the SIU, which is going to take some of the things, we quickly deal with them internally and maybe confirm them with other people. So these are all the processes in trying to frustrate these issues. But do remember that once you talk investigations, these become matters of law which can easily be contested. You have to be very meticulous when you deal with those issues, especially when there are going to be consequences for the people, either criminal or people losing their jobs. Hence, then, sometimes they become frustrating, but it's necessary.
All right. Can we, Dr. George, can we maybe allow the SIU to talk to us? I mean, what are they investigating? What is the volume of their work? What are their timelines? Are we going to have permanent investigations, or are we going to reach a point where we say we've come to the bottom of the issues and we are weeding things out?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Our investigation are phased approach. There's the focus in terms of the phase one, and then there's a focus in terms of the phase two. Like the Honorable Minister, they have spoken about the prestige accommodation, which we have just received a referral from the Minister whereby it will be part of the phase two. My colleague Naume will talk about the milestones and also the achievements that we have and the going forward. It's not like it's going to be a permanent investigation in the department. We will assist them with the turnaround strategy, keep focused areas, because we can't do everything that the department wants us to do. It needs to be timelined, milestones, and phased approach. So maybe Naume will talk to us when we started, and then what has we done and what we are busy with.
You'll assist them with the turnaround strategy. Did I hear you well? Is that what you said?
The turnaround strategy talks to the financial deficiencies that they are encountering in the terms of where financial regulation were not followed.
No, that's fine. I'm just interested because the gentleman there said he's helping with the turnaround. Is it part of the SIU? Are you from Deloitte? From the department?
Yes, in the turnaround.
Oh, okay. Continue. I'm not a Spanish bull, but some of these names, they are like a red flag. Continue.
Chairperson, in terms of the matters we're assisting the department with, they identified that there were irregularities primarily in the procurement space. And then you're looking at SEM procedures not being followed, systemic weaknesses, whether or not there was delivery in terms of contracts. So our proclamation is fairly wide. So what's happened is that basically the department would refer matters to us, which we would then investigate. Leases has been one of our primary focus areas, and I think the Minister has talked to this a lot in terms of the media and stuff. This would be your SAPS leases, the Transnet and Middlestad leases, most recently Wachthuis, you know, where we were looking at the extension of a lease worth something like $600 million. The department's also looking at certain instances of fronting. We currently have a matter before the Supreme Court where we want to set aside a lease that's worth $139 million. There are officials in the department who've colluded with landlords and actually leased premises in six instances that we've identified where there is no occupancy. And here the department has instructed attorneys to sue to the value of $28 million. We have instances where contractors actually take out insurance security and actually don't do the work. In one instance, we've got a matter where we've issued, where the department assisted the department in issuing a summons for $50 million. So what we're trying to say is in the course of our investigation, as we pick up matters, it's referred to the department and they action it, be it criminal matters, we facilitate that, whether it's to the ACDT or to the commercial courts. Disciplinary action, we assist in compiling the disciplinary files. And as the Minister previously indicated, we do have also various high-profile people. We've got your DDGs. The Head of Property Management is currently suspended. You know, we're also looking at the DG of the Prestige portfolio, etc. So I think that we're trying to send out a strong message that nobody is untouchable within the department. One of the areas we're also trying to assist with is to actually also give systemic recommendations, because obviously the reason this corruption is taking place is that there are gaps in the system which are vulnerable to abuse. So we would, for example, indicate which areas in the SEM process, how why it's so easy to manipulate it, and how we can circumvent it.
All right. Yes. No, not yet, Dr. Joshua. No, we'll come back to it.
I just want to ask a question of the SIU.
Come back to it, yeah.
Thank you for the feedback, but nowhere in the feedback did I hear that specific individuals, unless I missed it, specific individuals have been pinpointed, and that there is criminal prosecution in progress.
Specific individuals have been pinpointed, and they have been referred, like I said, to institutions like the ACDT, which is the anti-corruption task team, as well as to commercial crime. These instances include the DDG that we referred to, the head of property management, and various other individuals who have actually left the department but were involved in criminal activities during their time at the department. There we also have an instance which is currently with the ACTT in which a specific landlord was involved because two individuals in the department colluded and awarded 28 leases to him with $310 million. This is something that the AFU are still going to look at arrests. So, you know, at this stage we can't actually just name names and compromise what the NPA is doing. But what I think we're trying to do and what the department is definitely doing is, you know, people are being named and criminal action. It's not only a question of disciplinary action being taken to them, but where they have committed fraud, corruption, maladministration, they are being criminally prosecuted. Obviously, in terms of the criminal process, we have no control in terms of when the police decide to arrest and when the NPA decides to prosecute.
All right.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to hear it like that. Then I'm going to move on to procurement and contract management. I think that's been covered before, and we've had a discussion on this when, which wasn't specifically related, but when Limpopo was here, Minister, we had this discussion about what had gone wrong in the procurement process. Now, given that this financial statement is disclaimed, it's very hard for me to know, you know, what kind of reliability it has. And so also it's not quite clear what isn't in this report. So what I would like to know is, given that this disclaimer is here and we don't know what's missing, was there any expenditure on Nkandla, the President's homestead, in the period 1 April 2011 to 31 March 2012. Thank you.
I think, you know, Dr. George, I would love that the issues that are covered here in relation to non-compliance, if you could deal with them. Actually, I was about to ask you if you can wind down, because I think almost everything is non-compliant. So you may end up dealing with the whole report, so that we can allow other comrades to, you know, to make interventions. But I think that issue that you have raised, just park it or raise it. Because when we wrote to the minister, we indicated that it might be an issue that might arise, because we had so resolved last year that instead of dealing with it as a separate hearing, let's deal with it in the context of the annual report. And I'm sure the SIU spoke about the head of the Prestige portfolio. I'm sure Prestige portfolio would cover a wider margin than just that particular instance. So we'll talk to it later. I just want to check with you if, in terms of the specific areas of non-compliance, can you wind it down so that...
Chairperson, I'm pleased to tell you that I'm basically done. I wanted to ask a bit about investigation at the end, but it has been covered. So it is done. But I must reiterate what I've said about the question that I've raised, is that it is a matter that is on the table. And we did have a discussion before about this, and we said that when we have the discussion on the annual financial statements, we would have a discussion on it, and I understand what you're saying, but I do want my question answered. And the question is, because this is disclaimed and I have absolutely no idea, I want to know whether there was any expenditure on Kandla, the President's homestead, in the period 1 April 2011 to 31 March 2012, and how much it was. Thank you.
No, that's fine. That's fine. We'll come back to those elements. I'll start with, and can you please ask one or two questions, so that we can move around and around. Comrade Chilwane, Memangena, Singh, Dr. Ravi, and then the chairperson, and then
that if certain points I wish to cover,
yeah,
if Dr. George did not cover them, you would allow me to do so.
I will allow you.
When?
Soon and very soon. Yes, Comrade Chilwane.
Chairperson, if just a clarity before I ask a question, I wanted to check, do we do follow-ups on the issues which were raised by Honourable Ainsley and Honourable George, or do we just go throughout? Because I wanted to raise issues on the property management.
Sure.
What do
anything that is bugging you, here the people who have answered.
Okay.
Go for it.
Thank you, Chairperson. In that regard, I'm going to make a follow-up in terms of the what is it, page 156 on the issues raised by the AG on computer services and consultants. That is table 4.2 and table 4.3. I see at 4.2 there's CETA computer services and there's also external computer services to a total amount of 48.4 million. When you go to table 4.3, there's consultants, contracts, and agencies. We just want to have an interest, especially on the business and advisory services and agency and support of outsourced services.
Which page are you in, Comrade?
166, Chairperson.
166.
The expenditure,
okay.
Yes.
All right.
One would just want to know, Chairperson, in regard with 4.2, there's CETA, which deals with computer services, and there's also external computer service providers. What's the difference between the two? Because in my own understanding, that CETA is a regulated agency that assists department. And in terms of the consultants and contractors, we understand that the department need highly skilled people, hence there are consultants. But just want to know, share with your indulgence, to check this business and advisory. What is it that they are providing? And can we also get a list of these contractors and consultants? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. course, you had a jobs for health in the department. You will have a 14% vacancy rate, which is very low, but you still have to spend more than a quarter of a billion rand on, okay, or maybe a particular amount within that category that would otherwise not have been necessary had the right people been employed.
Chairperson, for the interest of the meeting, maybe also to, if you can get the list of these consultants to know. You remember that we're busy with the consultant hearings in the past 4 or 5 weeks to check on whether there are no people who are just doing business within all the departments around
right.
the country.
Can you note that down, Peter Paul? The name of the contractor, the duration, the amount, and the purpose. Can we talk to this outsourced services or consultants, contractors, computer services?
Yes. I will respond with regard to the list that is requested, Chair. May I apologize that we have not brought that list.
No, that's fine. We understand.
Yeah.
You will not
yeah.
have brought it because.
thank you. With regard to the business advisory services, would be consultants that are appointed to proper consultants, as you, they would be contributing, for example, to the technical areas such as. We had consultants who were working on the asset register, Ernest & Young, amongst them, but the actual list will be provided. But, Chair, these consultants were appointed simply because we've got this qualification. And it is clear that to resolve it, you are not going to be able to utilize the internal resources simply because these things have occurred with those internal resources. And the discrepancies would be the actual skills required to deal with some of the issues. If you look at the qualification of the PMTE, quite a lot of them are related to the extent that the asset register has not been completed, but some of them relate to what we will require to have a proper policy in place to account for the assets in line with the standards required to comply with the reporting that is required for auditing purposes. But the CFO is going to add on that. I also do not have the details with regard to the CETA question, but my understanding is that there would be contracts that either historically were in place that provide specific business IT solutions to the department, which were entered outside of the CETA. The ones that are under CETA are if you have contracted through CETA. We must recall that CETA also do not themselves deliver from their own resources. They sometimes also outsource these services. In some cases, the departments have been frustrated with the performance of CETA. But the details we can provide.
Can we get that in a week's time, Comrade Minister?
Chairperson, there is information that some system was procured for the purposes of assisting the department so that they can generate accurate reports which are based on the data drawn from the various systems which were used by the department. And there was some agreement entered into a contract with CETA some years back, which allowed for the government department to procure the software through this particular agreement. But I can tell you that in public works, somebody signed an agreement and approved for the payment of 40 million. Prior to the product being delivered or implemented. That matter is under the investigation by the SIU and it's 95% complete. So very soon we will be getting the report.
Which company is that which was paid before it performed?
Can you check us in, I request, for the purposes of this investigation, allow us not to talk these names. I'm requesting, Chair. We will come back with the report.
Because it may be read, but it might not be
We will come back with the report, Chair.
Okay. No,
for the purposes of the investigation.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. I mean, it shows this duplication, which the Honorable Member is talking about, that it does happen. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Honorable Minister, for the response. But I guess this one that you mentioned of 41 million is a different one to the other one that the DG has said will provide information for the purpose of us as we move forward in terms of the report. We'll await that report.
Thank you. Memange.
Chairperson, thank you very much. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm asking myself questions, especially the issue of Nkandla. I don't want to discuss about it. But you are always telling us that here we deal with corpses only. And if we bring a patient here, we are the ones who are going to kill it. So let's wait for the corpse to be brought to us so that we can dissect it and do whatever we're supposed to do. The issue on the lady who was fired, who was forced to resign. It really worries me. She's forced to resign, but there's a rot that she's leaving behind. Who's going to pay for those monies? Why didn't you just charge her? Even if it takes 3 years, it's okay. We're going to get our monies back from her. Now you force her to resign. Even these ones are still going to wait for you to force them. They will say, I'll do this. He will force me to resign. And they will resign, knowing very well that you will never, ever charge them. Thank you very much.
Briefly, Comrade Minister.
Briefly, Mama. In terms of the Honorable Sarah, yes. In terms of the law, if you have a violation or you have charges of misconduct, you even have the option to resign. It even says unless you resign, then we won't pursue you. It's there in the EU. But the issue is if you're liable criminally, even if you have resigned, we can still follow you.
Thank you.
Are you doing that with anybody? Just to follow up. Honorable Minister, are you doing that with anybody who has resigned and you're following up criminal charges? But that's the by-the-way question, but I think we'll get an answer. My other question, Honorable Chairperson, relates to, just following up on colleague Chilwane, is about the ICT environment within the organization. Because ICT is a bedrock to proper risk management. And what can you say about the ICT environment as it exists at the moment? That's my first question, Chairperson.
I think my observation and there is action also that relates to that is that our ICT environment is very weak. There have been reports that have been issued by the internal audit unit of the department that point to weaknesses, and I think they also correlate with reports that may have been issued by the Auditor General themselves with regard to specific areas where there were weaknesses. Again, in recent space, we also had a vacancy at a critical level, which is also being, I've instructed that it be filled and was advertised. If I'm correct. Yeah, it was one of the advertisements. Yes. Because I think it's critical, it's been identified that the whole ICT strategy of the department needs to be reviewed and reconstructed to deal with the nature and the way in which we want to do business going forward with the Justice Department. And that is, I think the Minister made reference to some of the things that are inherent in the weaknesses of that process. It is weak in the critical areas of the asset management, which is absolutely necessary if we are to then finalize the issue of having a proper system of dealing with our property management program in its totality.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, see, this relates to the organogram of the organization. Is the organogram linked to the strategic objectives and vision and mission of the department? And I would think no, from what I hear. And that's something that's radically wrong and requires radical surgery. But, Chair, I think the Honourable Minister can answer the question about the other question, people who have resigned. But I'm going to page 110 of this COPA's resolution as it relates to investigations. I mean, there are three investigations that have been listed there. I'd just like to know whether these investigations have been completed, what is the status of those investigations, and does the scope of the investigation include not only trying to identify that there was fraud and mismanagement and have criminal charges preferred against individuals you identify, but also recovery of monies where there was undue enrichment from not only officials but also from service providers? Is that something that is being done?
The first question, the cases which, criminal cases which have been opened, precisely deal with some people who have resigned. And we will get the details as those are progressing from the other ministries. Or from the other yes departments. The second question, it is correct that we're not just requesting the SIU to look at the weaknesses or procurement irregularities, violations and so on. We also look at how do we recover. One of the cases in Pretoria, for that matter, in relation to one of the buildings, is about how do we recover our money. So, where it's possible, depending on the legal advice we're getting, we go even into those options. So, at the end, the intention is it's not just to stop the leakages, to how to save the state resources where we can be able to do that.
Dr. Rabi?
In the auditor's report, in the consolidated report, I note that there's a lack of, let's say, coordination between the department and National Treasury in terms of the advice that National Treasury gives them. And if I just quote,